Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast, your source for policy discussions and carefully scripted humor. I'm Evan Schwartzstraber, your host. On today's show, regulating new technologies. You may not know much about the most important agency in Washington when it comes to regulating new technologies. The Federal Trade Commission, or FTC for short, is for better or worse becoming the Federal Technology Commission. Joining me to discuss this is new technology himself, Baron Soka, president of Tech Freedom. Baron.
You know, every time you tweak your opening, it becomes more rigid.
Ah, so, you know, I'm glad you said that because I wanted to bring something up. On our last podcast, according to two of my coworkers, you were mean to me. They said that not only did you mock my laugh, you also mocked me for not having a law degree. And you've now mocked my demeanor within 1 minute of this show starting when you didn't even know that I was going to reference you being mean to me on the last show. So is there nothing more emblematic of the problem than this?
Nope.
I mean...
But at least I'm not doing it in front of your mom. I was very nice to you when she was here.
Oh, yeah. Great. Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, for what it's worth, our listeners should know that the running joke here is, in fact, that as much as I might tease you about this, in fact, I'm apparently, according to listener feedback... let's see, what was it?
Tedious.
Tedious. That was the main word. And that was a friend that I've had for about 12 years. So, but he was very honest, and I take the feedback to heart. And so I'm trying to liven it up more. And, you know, there's no better way to be funny than to be mean to the people that work for you.
Insult comedy, that new exciting genre of comedy.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, Baron, let's just start with the basics. The Federal Trade Commission, not necessarily a household name. It's America's chief privacy regulator. It deals with issues of data security, online child protection.
And importantly, and Julie Brill, who we're going to talk about today, once told me this at a dinner, at an event. She said that when she talks to people about her job and she says, you know, I work at the Federal Trade Commission, they assume that she's talking about international trade. And she has to say, oh, no, it's about domestic commerce and all the companies you deal with, basically, except for banks and common carriers. They're all regulated by the FTC.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's misleading about the name, which is why we've been calling it the Federal Technology Commission.
And we're not the only ones. That question was asked to Edith Ramirez, the chairman of the FTC, on Marketplace just last week or the week before, and she didn't disagree. I mean, for better or worse, the FTC really is becoming the de facto Federal Technology Commission.
And on Tuesday, Commissioner Julie Brill, one of the three Democrats in the majority, decided to resign. And in our world, this is breaking news because these appointments really do matter. And there's another vacancy on the commission left by a friend of Tech Freedom, Josh Wright, who was one of the two Republicans. So now we have three commissioners on what is supposed to be a five commission agency. And the reason this is important is because these types of things usually work better in pairs, as you said in your statement on Tuesday, that in order to have a smoother time nominating and confirming commissioners in a partisan Congress, it's better to have the two go together.
Well, it's not just that it's better. It's just that the Senate never really actually moves anybody without a dancing partner. Sometimes the dancing partner is from the same agency. That tends to work the best. Sometimes it's a whole package of commissioners, both Democrats and Republicans from various agencies. You put enough in, you sweeten the pot for both sides, and you get stuff done. The point is just that here, Josh's seat has sat vacant since last summer. And now that there is a Democratic seat vacant as well, it really should be pretty easy for the president and Mitch McConnell to come together and pick replacements on both sides. It wouldn't change the balance of power. It doesn't hurt either side. It just ensures that the commission has a full deck.
So we're saying it's really the Federal Technology Commission these days, but the FTC's been around for obviously longer than the commercial internet and longer than the modern technological era. What was the agency best known for in its history? Just to quickly kind of summarize how it evolved from a antitrust or a trade regulator to a technology regulator.
So the FTC was one of President Wilson's creations. It has been around now for over 100 years, and it initially, for the first 24 or so years, just regulated antitrust. It essentially had a broader standard than did the Department of Justice for antitrust. Then the FTC was given authority over consumer protection, making that a federal matter. And to make a long story short, the FTC now has two bureaus, one that does competition in conjunction with the Department of Justice, enforcing the antitrust laws, and a little bit its own murky, unfair methods of competition, but mostly antitrust laws. And then there's the Bureau of Consumer Protection, which handles traditionally handled advertising. So basically, until the 1990s, that's what the Bureau of Consumer Protection did. It was advertising and warranties, and just essentially making sure that consumers didn't get ripped off, that companies weren't deceiving them. And it's an important distinction, because that is generally unambiguous. If a company says they're going to do something and they don't, even a libertarian doesn't have a problem with the government coming in and punishing them. But the FTC in the there were really two phases of this. In the 1970s, the FTC started to go beyond that kind of deception activity and to start bringing unfairness cases that really were much more in the line of policymaking. The FTC chairman in the late 1970s, at a time when the Carter administration was actually very deregulatory, and in fact, Carter was very much a centrist, contrary to what people remember today. But for a variety of reasons, his FTC chairman, Michael Perchuk, tried to regulate everything from funeral home practices and casket sales to, most famously, trying to ban the advertising of sugared cereal to children.
Right. You read my mind, because, as you said before, even a libertarian might see the need for an agency to protect consumers. But the relevance of the agency was called into question in the 1970s as its scope started to expand beyond. And what I specifically want to reference is a editorial from the Washington Post, which is not exactly the most right-wing publication in America, the most anti-government publication in America. They had an editorial that referred to the FTC as National Nanny. So what led to that?
Yeah, well, again, it was just one of many rulemakings that the FTC had going on at the time, trying to use their very broad unfairness authority. And they were essentially saying that, hey, anything could be unfair if it somehow affected consumers. It could be environmental issues or workplace safety or advertising of things that kids shouldn't eat. And that was the bridge too far. And that's what led the FTC to call them the National Nanny. And this history is really important. Nobody in DC talks about it. There's almost nobody left at the agency who was there who remembers this stuff. But it didn't just question the agency's relevance. It quite literally led a Democratic Congress to close the agency in the first modern government shutdown in 1980, where the agency had Congress had been trying to get the agency to constrain its interpretation of unfairness in particular, and the FTC wasn't willing to do it, and there was a breakdown over government funding, and Congress just let the agency close. And it is no exaggeration to say that the agency survived this political crisis by being willing to, at the end of 1980, finally issue the unfairness policy statement, where they said, okay, well, we're not going to just go around deciding what's unfair based on our trying to imagine what public policy should be. We're going to have a test. And the test is, we're going to focus on substantial injury that is not outweighed by countervailing benefit that consumers themselves cannot reasonably avoid. That three-part test literally saved the agency, and Congress later put it into statute in 1994.
So the reasonably avoid part of that is probably what the Washington Post was referring to with the nanny article, that really, when you're getting into the area where you're just trying to supplant parenting and basic things like knowing that sugar-filled cereal should not be eaten three meals a day every day, or like that's just obvious stuff, and we need to have some reasonable expectation of consumers to be informed, and we can't have such a broad definition of unfairness that basically every single company that tries to market its product is being unfair.
Yeah, that's right. And so that the FTC really was put back on sound footing in 1980. 3 years later, they issued another policy statement, this one about deception, saying that no, not every single misleading statement is deceptive. It has to be material. It has to actually drive consumer choices. And so the FTC really was just doing fine after that. And then in the 90s, The FTC started dealing with the internet and new technologies and things like information brokers.
And that was kind of just by default, right? I mean, was is there another path that could have been taken? Or really you have the dawn of the commercial internet, not necessarily a huge body of law in Congress dealing with the internet, so it kind of just fell into their lap?
Well, again, they are the regulator of every company in America other than banks and common carriers. And so, yeah, it was a reason it fell into their lap. And moreover, not only do they have jurisdiction, but they also have these incredibly broad and flexible standards. So, for example, privacy policies are enforced primarily through the FTC. If you say you're going to do something and you don't do it, or you do the opposite, the FTC goes after you. So that led them to do enforcement in this area. And it's important to note that they, I don't want to get too deep in the history here, but they initially said we can do just fine regulating under that authority in 1998. And then in 2000, in the waning days of the Clinton administration, they came out and said, actually, we think that the U.S. should have a comprehensive baseline privacy legislation. And that has sort of been the fight ever since, is since Congress hasn't decided to do that, and we have had a number of what we call sectoral grants of authority. So we have one that's over children's privacy, and we have one over fair credit reporting, and a few other specific statutes. The FTC has been left to regulate in the breach. And so the point today is that under the Obama administration, the FTC has become far more active and has really expanded dramatically upon the enforcement that the Bush FTC got into in data security, where they started going after clearly really terrible data security practices. This FTC under Edith Ramirez and her predecessor, Chairman Leibowitz, encouraged by people like Julie Brill, have taken a very aggressive stance to using the FTC's unfairness authority and also its deception authority to bring cases around not only privacy and data security, but also things like product design. And the most famous case there was the Apple case, where the FTC said essentially, look, too many kids were able to make purchases on the iTunes store because of the way that Apple had designed the store. Apple, in order to maximize the convenience of most users, had left a window open of 15 minutes where you could make purchases after the parent logged in. And so the FTC decided that wasn't an appropriate balance, and that Apple ought to redesign its product. So that's the kind of thing that we're getting into today, where the FTC, as we say, really is starting to regulate all aspects of technology where they have jurisdiction. And that, of course, I should note, means it no longer means broadband, because the FCC has taken that over. But for everything else, the FTC has these broad grants of authority, and they're quite willing to use them.
So let's talk about what that looks like at a broader level. The key question that new technology raises is how to have the right mix of the certainty that businesses need to operate and the flexibility that technological progress demands. I mean, clearly you can't just have no laws that don't do anything, because when new technologies arise, there are consumer protection issues. But you can't also just have complete regulatory blank check where there is no constraint and the agency can do whatever it wants, because that is the very definition of uncertainty. When companies have no idea how the regulator is going to react, they are going to be less likely to experiment and do the kind of entrepreneurial things that drive our economy. And in a piece you wrote for TechDirt a couple years ago, when you're talking about the Federal Technology Commission, you laid out three models of regulation. Regulatory model, which we mostly see with agencies like the FCC, where it's largely driven by politics,
rules,
and agenda.
Writing formal regulations.
Yeah.
That's what most people think of.
Right. That's, yeah, you issue some type of document, you say this is regulation, and then we vote on it, and then that's the regulation that's on the books. But then you have, and really the problem with that you argue is that's technocrats. That's people who say new technology is good if I can pull certain policy levers and engineer certain outcomes, right? It's they're always saying that, yes, new technology is good. They embrace it with the caveat that they need to be in some type of driver's seat as the technology develops.
Yeah.
And then, so that's really what we see with the FCC. We've, you know, griped about that on the podcast. But then what's more apt for the FTC is discretionary model. Can you explain a little bit what you mean by that?
Yeah, well, here, let me back up a step. So most people most people think, well, I'm skeptical about regulation. I want the government to regulate yet less. And when they talk about deregulation, you know, when we use that word, we never actually mean that there shouldn't be any role for government. It's just a question of what the model is. And so what we generally prefer is regulating case by case, usually after the fact, instead of writing prescriptive rules in advance, right? So that's a traditional common law model, right? That is more how the FTC has functioned. It's certainly how, for example, antitrust works, right? So remember I said the FTC handles both antitrust and also consumer protection. And if you think about those two halves of the agency, you see the story pretty well, but this also is true for the FCC. So on the Bureau of Competition side, the agency goes to court. They bring cases. They sue and say, look, this went too far. This practice violates the antitrust laws. That is an adjudicatory process that is, I think, a very good one for dealing with new technologies. Now, when I use the term discretionary model, what I'm really saying is that the people at the FCC and the FTC have essentially created a third model, right? So it's different from the normal regulatory model because there are no clear rules that are written in advance. And it's different from the adjudicatory true common law model in a number of ways. But it boils down to the idea that in true common law fashion, the agency itself doesn't have that much discretion. It is going to court and making cases, and it has to convince the court that it's right, and it often loses. And so if you're in that kind of agency, who runs the agency is much less important. So when the new person that handles antitrust at the Department of Justice is selected, it does matter. It does change on the margins where the agency is going to go, but not hugely, because the agency has to go to court and still has a body of law that constrains them. They don't have totally unchecked discretion. In short, they still have the burden of justifying their actions, of showing that what they're doing actually makes consumers better off. But in the discretionary model, that doesn't exist. That the agencies don't go to court. They settle cases out of court because they have all sorts of pressure to bring to bear over companies. And so even when they have standards like unfairness and deception that at least in theory have some analytical rigor, they don't actually mean anything in practice. So when you look, for example, at the 50 or more data security cases and about the same number of privacy cases that the FTC has brought, the FTC says, oh, look at our common law of consent decrees. You'll find all the answers you need there. Well, you can look at those and you will not actually find any real weighing of costs and benefits, any real analysis of what consumers can reasonably avoid. What you really find is the agency just takes a 3-2 vote and they decide that something is unfair. And so we were right back into the sort of thing that happened in the 1970s, except now it's being done through this kind of perverse adjudication instead of by rulemaking.
So to just highlight a few key points here, what we're talking about with the FCC, the regulatory model, that's just you issue rules and they're on the books and you either follow them or you don't. When we talk about discretion, the difference is there was no rule that Apple had to have its store be a certain way. What the agency has to do is convince a court that what it did was unfair or deceptive. And whereas having 5 commissioners on the FCC, 3 of the president's party and 2 not, that matters a lot because it's regulatory, because they're issuing rules. Whereas what you suggested, the FTC could be controlled by Democrats, it could be controlled by Republicans, it's still got to convince a court. Well, and that's important.
Right. But that's in, if you will, the true common law model.
Right. And the problem that we're identifying is the consent decrees. And just to use an example for listeners, when companies settle, a lot of times, if not all the time, the implication is we are not admitting any wrongdoing. And you see examples of this after the 2008.
Well, in every single case. Right. That's what a consent decree means.
Right. So in the 2008 financial crisis, you had a lot of people alleging that companies committed fraud. And you had companies like Goldman Sachs paying out $500 million in fines. But they paid $500 million in fine, and that doesn't mean they're going to admit wrongdoing. So that doesn't then result in some sort of precedent for future behavior where they can't do the thing that they're accused of, except the FTC, when it gets companies to settle, they're now treating that as a legal precedent when really it's not. All they did was get Apple to say, get off our back, here's some money, go away. And now the agency's going to turn around and say, well, no, look, Apple paid a fine, so that means the next company that comes along and does that, we can fine them too.
Yeah, and this might seem like a lawyerly distinction, and who cares whether the company actually admitted anything, but it actually really matters.
Yeah.
And it matters at least for two reasons. Number one, in a consent decree, you don't have all the facts, right? Part of the point of litigation is that you have an independent trier of fact that sifts through the arguments on both sides and comes up with what he or she thinks really happened. When you get a settlement, you don't really know. You have the government's charges, and the company might get the government to change on the margins what it says, but it is not a fair and accurate representation of what happened. It is one side of the story. And then second, you don't have any real legal analysis. I mean, sometimes you get a little bit of it because you get a dissent. So Josh Wright, as you said, friend of ours who used to be on the FTC, he was great about this because he challenged the agency. In the Apple case, he said, well, hold on, let's actually think through what the legal standard means here. And I don't think it's been satisfied. That very rarely happens. And without him on the commission, it's essentially not happening at all. You might get an occasional dissent where Commissioner Olhausen says, well, I wouldn't have brought this case as a matter of prosecutorial discretion because I don't think it's actually making consumers better off. But it doesn't... That's different
than saying this is not lawful.
And the point is, it's not common law. It is the agency just doing essentially whatever it wants.
And I'd like to wrap up soon. But we have this problem. We have the company, the country's chief regulator of domestic companies really just kind of operating on this common law of consent decrees, as you call it, which is creating legal precedent where it's not really a legal precedent, and then binding companies to future behavior based on just court settlements.
Yeah, without really any constraint on their discretion.
They didn't actually convince the court. They didn't win the case. They didn't lose the case. They just got some money.
And they're not building doctrine. I mean, it's fundamentally different from antitrust, where if on a particular question, you have lots of cases to look at. You can, when you go to law school, you take an antitrust class and you can learn how the law evolves and it changes. And sometimes the courts think that something should be illegal in all cases, and then they move towards saying, actually, it has some benefits and we should be more careful about it. And they may move more towards saying it should be legal. But that's a legal process that is informed by economics and other disciplines.
And is that how you, if you could reform the agency, which is something that Tech Freedom works on, or one of the few organizations in DC that really cares about the way that the FTC works, if you could just briefly say a couple of things about how you would reform the agency to make it work better, including what you just said.
The number one thing, the immediate thing, is now that we have two vacancies, those have to be filled. Because the practical reality is that the main constraint on the agency is the commissioners. And if you don't have more voices there, and especially somebody who, like Josh, is an economist and who can think very carefully about how you would do the kind of careful economic weighing on consumer protection that happens every day at the Bureau of Competition, right? In other words, what we need is somebody who will bring that law and economics revolution and looking at other disciplines and thinking carefully about technical trade-offs and so on. If you don't have someone who does that, the commission is just going to run wild. So that would be the number one thing I would say. But you know, we're working on a longer project on FTC reform. There's no simple answer. There are lots of small changes that would help. But I would say that the next biggest thing on my list would be making sure that there is actually a legal standard for settling cases. Because right now, this is the most perverse thing. The chairman will often say, well, look, we've settled all these cases. This is our common law. When you read each of those cases, you will note that what they're actually doing is saying all the statute requires us to do is to say that we have reason to believe a violation occurred and that the investigation, not even the settlement, would be in the public interest. In other words, there is a standard in the statute for when the FTC opens an investigation. There's no standard for settling a case. And ironically, even the standard for opening the investigation is in fact only really used at the end of the process, because the staff, because there are these standing orders that authorize them to go bring investigations, they essentially bypass even that requirement. They just go out, do whatever they want to do. They then come to the commission and they say, we have a settlement ready to go, and please sign off on it, and then maybe you get a vote. And that's how the LabMD case went down. So this cancer testing lab, the largest one in the Southeast, was driven out of business because it was pursued for years by the FTC.
Right. So really, the short answer is more cost-benefit analysis, more real careful weighing of consumer harms and benefits, and saying just because it sounds good to ding a company or to say that what you did was bad, you might be harming consumers by preventing that company from doing it. And we've used the example of the Apple Store throwing up more roadblocks. There's a consumer harm there. It makes it less convenient to use. The agency has to weigh that, and just having more checks and more barriers is not necessarily best for consumers. And we'll certainly be talking about these issues on future podcasts, but that's it for today's show. My guest has been new technology enthusiast Baron Soka, who often struggles to figure out how to work his phone. Baron.
and all joking aside, Evan, you know I love you, right?
Well, according to the podcast, you don't, and that's our common law of consent decrees, but maybe someone else could find evidence to the contrary. We'd love to hear what you think of the show. Please tweet your thoughts and suggestions to us at Tech Freedom, or email media at techfreedom.org. We'd love to hear, pitch yourself as a guest if you like tech, or tell us what you think of certain episodes, tell us what your favorite topics are and what we should be talking about. And of course, follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook, and find this podcast in the iTunes store on your favorite podcast app. And please leave us a review so others can find the show. Thank you for listening, and hopefully next time Baron will be nice to me.
Maybe.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.